This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars, episode number 51, was recorded on August 28th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. Forest for the Trees founder Luke Grohman is back with us today. Luke, I hope you had a fantastic holiday weekend. What's on your mind this week?
Hey, Eric, I did. Hopefully you did as well. So, you know, what caught my attention is about 3 weeks ago, CNBC's Carl Quintanilla highlighted a tweet, really, that the 10-year Treasury yield had been cut in half since an October 12, 2018 appearance on CNBC by Larry Kudlow that Quintanilla screenshotted and put in the tweet. Larry Kudlow saying there's no end in sight to our economic boom. That October 12, 2018 that Quintanilla cited jumped out at us because on that very day, there was an article that came out that explicitly said something that had recently happened that meant the U.S. economic boom had likely just ended. And the title of that article was Foreigners Can No Longer Underwrite the U.S. Economic Expansion. It was an October 12, 2018 edition of Financial Times. I'm going to read a quick excerpt of it, if you don't mind, just because it highlights some important points. So the article says, you know those bells that are supposed to never ring to signal a turn in the market? Well, they started ringing on September 27 and 28. On that Thursday and Friday, just before the end of the third quarter, the interbank market's cross-currency basis swap for euros to U.S. dollars rose by 30 basis points. In the same period, the cost of yen-dollar basis swaps went up by 46 basis points. That was the end of foreigners paying for the U.S.'s economic expansion. It probably also marked the end of the housing recovery. The effect of those changes was to make it uneconomic for European or Japanese investors to buy U.S. Treasury bonds and hedge away the currency risk. He goes on to say a number of other things. The article was by John Dizzard, but two last important points were that the BIS estimated in 2016 that the missing debt amounts to some $13 to $14 trillion, but the implications for financial stability are quite subtle and require an assessment of both currency and maturity mismatches. Dizzard says, to sum up those subtle implications, the U.S. had borrowed an extra $14 trillion or so, and the currency risk assumed by the foreigners lending this money had been principally covered by the U.S. banking system, which had underestimated how dangerous this could be. And so he goes on, it says that anecdotally, as the end of the third quarter of this year approached, the regulators leaning over the large banks' trading desks indicated that it would be a good idea to cut back on all that swaps exposure.
Okay, Luke, I have a couple of questions. The first one, though, I know you're really good at putting things in perspective. So how about translating this article to plain English for the mere mortals in the audience?
You're very kind. Sure, I'm happy to do that. So in plain English, what this article said is that up until October of last year, primarily U.S. banks were growing their FX swap books basically endlessly, which basically offers attractively priced insurance on a fall in the dollar that allowed the global private sector to continue to buy treasuries, totally hedge the dollar risk out of those treasuries, and still make a positive nominal carry. And so banks' FX swap books had to grow endlessly to do this, you know, to facilitate this for two reasons. The first is because U.S. deficits are growing endlessly, of course. And two, because as we've noted repeatedly, global central banks stopped growing their holdings of treasuries in the third quarter of 2014. And so basically what was happening or what began happening last fall is akin to what happened to subprime mortgage insurance in the mid-2000s with credit default swaps. So, you know, back then, banks were selling cheap credit default swaps to anyone with an ISDA derivative license that wanted to buy that insurance. And that was allowing, ultimately, it was allowing people that probably should not have been taking out subprime mortgages to take out subprime mortgages. Now, if we remember, this continued until roughly 2007, when Wall Street banks famously stopped selling credit default swaps and turned buyers of those credit default swaps themselves, once they realized what was happening in the housing market. Or said differently, insurance on subprime mortgages effectively went no offer in 2007. And so to break this article down, you know, similarly, what this article says is that U.S. banks had been selling dollar insurance, FX swaps, to anyone that wanted to buy dollar insurance. The end result being that the U.S. banks doing this had up until late 2018 basically allowed the U.S. government to borrow an extra $14 trillion or so, with the currency risk assumed by the foreigners lending this money principally covered by the U.S. banking system, which had underestimated how dangerous this could be, which is, of course, what the article says. So, you know, to continue the metaphor from 2007, similar to how insurance on subprime mortgage bonds went no offer in 2007, what happened last October was that FX swap insurance on the dollar effectively went no offer. And from that point on, the foreign private sector either had to take a significantly negative yields on treasuries after paying FX hedging costs, or leave the treasury positions unhedged for dollar risk, or as their positions came up to be rolled, take their money out of treasuries and deploy it into bonds in their home currency that would have better yields than FX hedged treasuries.
Wow. Okay. So then my second question is, when you read this article originally, not now, but back then, did you perceive this importance at that time?
You know, we did. Shortly after this article came out, we released a full-length report with the following title. It said, "Negative FX hedged treasury yields for foreign investors equals risk off, rates up until the dollar's devalued." And within the report, we went on to say that basically it's going to be a dollar up and risk off scenario. We got that right. We whiffed on the rates up call because we didn't understand the money market plumbing well enough to realize that where rates would rise would be at the Fed funds rising above interest on excess reserves rather than at the belly of the curve and out at the long end. And, you know, that's a phenomenon we now understand and have harped on repeatedly in recent months, including on prior episodes of Macro Voices. And so what's transpired since we wrote this report last year on October 18th is, you know, exactly what the article said, the FT article said on October 12th, the end of the U.S. recovery. You know, since then, we've seen a relentless drop in treasury yields and global sovereign debt yields in total. Even as something odd has been happening, you know, both throughout fourth quarter 18 and which has continued since, which is that treasury auctions have gone increasingly poorly with big tails, weak bid to cover ratios, and U.S. primary dealers being forced to hold significantly greater amounts of treasuries, as we discussed last week and in prior weeks. Basically, we think this is sort of in effect to prevent treasuries from quote unquote failing. Not that they can fail, but that basically they were becoming the buyer of last resort.
Okay, so where do you think we stand right now in this process?
So in my opinion, you know, the first key takeaway from all this is that we're nearly a year into the event that forced the drop in treasury yields, which to us suggests this game is much more in the later innings, if you will. So we want to make it clear that what we're seeing in markets today, especially in terms of what's going on in the bond market, actually began way back in late September 2018, not a few weeks ago or you know, a few months ago. And as such, I think we might be much further along than most market participants realize.
Okay, Luke. So are there any signs or signals that you're watching for in terms of signposts of whether we're, you know, in the seventh inning or the eighth inning or the ninth inning? And if so, what are they?
Yeah, there are. And, you know, as we've noted on prior Macro Voices, you know, Fed funds rates being over IOER was for us the first big signal that things were getting more critical or more acute. And I think that theme's starting to get more mainstream, which is interesting. You know, I would say as an example of that theme getting more mainstream is last weekend, FT Alphaville had a great article entitled "There's a Black Hole in the Dollar Funding Market." And this article reviewed a great note from Zoltan Pozsar at Credit Suisse. And the article covered a number of sort of esoteric plumbing issues, you know, that he raised in his note in the article. But I thought the key line was this, quote, "In short, there are too many dollar-denominated safe assets in the market and not enough liquidity, and hence, very possibly, the makings of a fresh liquidity crisis."
Okay, so what was so important about that line in specific, in your view?
The line, "too many dollar-denominated safe assets and not enough liquidity." You know, what they're saying, that too much treasury bill issuance and not enough balance sheet to buy it all. And this is a direct result of the dollar hedging market effectively going no offer last fall. The global private sector is on the margin being paid to buy their own domestic nominally negative yielding debt rather than FX hedged treasuries that are even more negative yielding. And so what it tells us is that the U.S. fiscal problems are getting quite acute, and the symptom is what global sovereign debt yields are doing. And you know, as one brilliant customer of ours said to us, and we talked about this with them earlier this year, they said, Luke, FX hedge treasury yields going negative because dollar hedges have effectively gone no offer, you know, basically means the dollar's already screwed. And I think that's 100% right. And there are a few important corollaries to that observation.
Okay, what are some of those corollaries?
Well, for starters, as long as U.S. deficits keep rising and U.S. banks are not growing their FX swaps books enough, the cost to hedge dollars should keep rising. And so FX hedge treasury yields should keep getting more negative, which means that foreign sovereign yields should keep getting more and more negative, because you know what this all means is the baseline is no longer 0% on sovereign debt, given the regulatory environment we're all in. But the baseline is now, or the decision point is now, what are FX hedge treasury yields doing? So as long as FX hedge treasury yields keep getting more negative for the reasons we talked about, money's likely going to continue flowing into negative yields in the EU and Japan and elsewhere, so long as those nominal yields are less negative than FX hedge treasury yields of comparable tenors.
You know, that's a really interesting thought process, Luke. So many of us are used to thinking about interest rate differentials between U.S. treasuries and other sovereigns, but thinking about them in hedged terms. What's the hedged cost after you hedge out the FX risk, and how does that compare? What's that differential evaluation is actually more relevant in many ways. I really am not used to thinking about it that way, so thank you for that enlightenment. What are some other corollaries, since you seem to be on a roll here?
You know, as long as the machinery that I described earlier keeps turning as is, and the regulatory environment, you know, Basel III and et cetera, remains in force, then it tells you global sovereign yield should keep getting more and more negative, which I think should continue to be really good for gold.
That makes sense. One thing that I don't understand, though, is if hedges on the U.S. dollar have effectively gone no offer, why has the U.S. dollar been very much up since that happened?
It's a great question. You know, I think it's because ironically, the dollar hedges going no offer reduces global dollar liquidity, and that drives the dollar up instead of down, or you know, for at least a time. And, you know, remember, as I noted earlier, we're now at least a year into this game.
Luke, I notice a curious intonation in your words, at least for a time. So you seem to be implying that that's going to change. When do you think that changes and what happens next?
You know, the answer to that question, I think, is contained in the statement that we highlighted before, made by Zoltan Pozsar and quoted in the FT, which is that, in short, there are too many dollar-denominated safe assets in the market and not enough liquidity, and hence, very possibly, the makings of a fresh liquidity crisis. And so, you know, basically, this machinery is all dollar positive until the dollar shortage comes home to U.S. shores and the U.S. private sector, and especially the U.S. banking system, begins to run out of balance sheet capacity from a regulatory perspective or overall, you know, to warehouse all this treasury issuance. And it's important to remember, around 70% of treasury issuance is 1 year or less in duration. And so as that capacity to buy all this T-bill issuance gets tighter, either we'll get the liquidity crisis that Pozsar speaks of in that quote, or the Fed will begin injecting growing amounts of dollar liquidity, I think permanently, any number of ways. And, you know, this dynamic is what we've called Voldemort before, which is, you know, effectively a U.S. fiscal crisis. And as in the case of the Harry Potter movies, if the quote unquote chosen one, Harry Potter in the movies, the dollar in this case, if the chosen one, quote unquote, is to quote unquote die, it's essential that Voldemort sort of, you know, quote, kills Harry. And so to explain that analogy, what dollar insurance going no offer effectively will ensure is that U.S. fiscal deficits will force the Fed to effectively monetize U.S. deficits going forward permanently, which we think will force a significant change in the structure of the dollar's reserve status that we think is already being hinted at pretty strongly by record central bank gold buying, especially in the face of really no increases in central bank treasury holdings over the past 6 years.
So how are you playing what you think is possibly a liquidity crisis driven by the machinery that you described above? It seems to me a liquidity crisis could be dollar positive, but I know you've got some real concerns about the dollar.
Yeah, I think, you know, it all comes down to how long one thinks the U.S. government and Fed will allow said liquidity crisis to persist. And then secondarily, understanding how nimble one can be as a trader, given one's pool of capital. And then lastly, just one's handicapping of the risks that markets will remain contiguous through that whole process. And so, you know, for me, I personally think the liquidity crisis is close. I don't think I'm nimble enough to trade them with my pool of capital. And I think that there's significant risk that markets will effectively be discontiguous or perhaps outright discontiguous, like, you know, post 9/11 when markets were shut down for a few days, for example. And so in terms of how I'm positioned for how I see this developing is I'm still very long gold, Bitcoin. I'm still overweight equities versus bonds, which is has been quite wrong year to date in terms of being overweight equities versus bonds. It's been a home run trade to be long bonds. But, you know, I just think what all of this tells us is that in terms of the machinery to be described is that I think the period when a quorum of participants in the bond market begins to realize that the Fed's close to being forced to effectively finance U.S. governments permanently, I think that period of time where that quorum of people realize that is very rapidly approaching.
Luke, I'm particularly interested in that last point you made, because I see your point. You're basically saying, look, you know, we're kind of getting to a day of reckoning here for the U.S. government not being able to continue its deficit spending. But, you know, I remember when quantitative easing first started in the spring of 2009, and my immediate reaction is, this is not going to work. The market's going to see through it as an act of desperation. You know, they can't just print money out of thin air and expect to solve problems that way. Well, they did. And I don't know that they solved any problem, but there's been at least a 10-year reprieve on any of the symptoms that we were feeling back in 2008 and 2009. So it seems to me that the counter to this is kind of what Ray Dalio said, which is, you know, the Fed can conjure money out of thin air. If there's going to be a liquidity crisis, what's to stop them from just, you know, unlimited amounts of liquidity injections in order to quell it? And why would they let U.S. Treasury yields back up if that's not to their benefit, when they can always print more money and buy more treasuries and then make the yield go down?
It's a great question. And it's I'm absolutely counting on the fact that they won't allow that to happen. In other words, you know, there's the list of governments throughout history that have had a purely fiat currency and have allowed themselves to go out of business for lack of printing said fiat currency is very, very short. As far as I know, it's zero. And so I think Dalio's exactly on the right track. And, you know, it's important. You think about Dalio really started highlighting this issue last September. And he thought we had maybe 2 years at that point. And we, you know, we were writing about it a little bit in August and in September. And we said, take the under. When Dalio said that, we said, take the under on 2 years, particularly if there's any crises really anywhere in the ensuing timeframe. Well, no sooner had we said that than, you know, you had this, the machinery we described earlier today helped spur a liquidity-driven risk off in the fourth quarter of 18. And all that effectively helped do in the context of your question is take that two-year time frame that Dalio highlighted and shorten it. And so the bottom line to me is I think that's exactly what's going to happen. You know, it was fascinating. There was a report out, was referenced 2 weeks ago by Philip Hildebrand, who used to be with the Swiss National Bank, Stan Fisher, who was the former vice chairman of the Fed. They're now with BlackRock. And this report ahead of Jackson Hole laid out basically, hey, we need to do direct monetary financing of deficits or helicopter money to get out of this. And if this causes yields to back up, then we'll just cap yields. And so to me, ultimately, I think what you highlight is exactly how they will sort of keep this all going. And it's why we're negative on the dollar, right? As I think, you know, we're much closer to them needing to do this than expected. And the lead up to that is clearly dollar positive. But as we said, given the risks for discontiguous markets, given, you know, myself not being convinced I can trade around it that nimbly, even if markets aren't discontiguous, we would just rather be positioned for what we think is that inevitability of the Fed doing what it needs to do in terms of liquidity.
So when we get to the point where the market figures out, as you describe it, that the Fed's not going to really have any choice but to effectively monetize or finance U.S. government deficits, what happens at that point? Because, you know, my gut reaction wants to be, okay, at that point, the market wakes up and, you know, the bond market sells off dramatically as people realize that this is a desperate situation. But from everything that we've seen in the last 10 years, I wouldn't expect that at all. I would say, oh, look, we know that the Fed has to put basically a floor under the bond market. We know it's a safe trade because we know the stakes are so high if Treasury yields start to back up, that they're not going to let it happen. They maybe pile in some more. And I think that's crazy. It doesn't make sense. But, you know, look at what's happened for the last 10 years. People take don't fight the Fed to a new extreme of front run the Fed at any possible opportunity. So is it basically that bond yields stay or Treasury yields stay super low as they've been, but the dollar collapses at that point because people recognize that the Fed is going to have to continue to dilute the money supply in order to keep those rates low? Or what is it? Is it just a dollar move? How does it play out in markets?
Yeah, I think that's right, right? Like, you know, last time you and I talked about that, you know, the equity markets and the bond markets and the dollar, you know, one of the three is wrong. And everybody seems to think it's the equity market, or most everybody. And we think it's the dollar. And I think that's exactly right. Is, you know, we have a good friend of ours who says, you know, it's been the best way to play these markets over the last, you know, decade has been to sort of take the most perverse, counterintuitive outcome and bet on that, right? To your point. And so your point of what would bond markets do, you know, I would think they'd back up a little bit, but either out of fear that the Fed would cap them or out of the Fed actually capping them, I just don't think there's a whole lot of upside where yields could sort of run away. And in no small part, because as you noted, they just, it's a matter of national security that they don't. And so what I think ultimately where the release valve is the international trade value of the dollar. And I think that's where it's going. And I think that, you know, you may need a crisis to get there, but what this machinery we described today tells you that that crisis that could serve as such political cover for that is bearing down right on us.
Well, Luke, I can't thank you enough for another fantastic All-Stars interview. We look forward to getting an update from you in a couple of weeks. Meanwhile, listeners, be sure to stay tuned. We're back to our regular show format for the Thursday Night Flagship podcast this week, and we've got some more All-Stars content coming your way this week as well. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.